This is, you're talking about the fact that the delta m was proportional to the top quark mass squared? Which amplitude? Which amplitude? Are you talking about when I was doing the estimate that this curly C was, you know, it was G Fermi squared over 16 pi squared. Is this the mass that you're talking about? Yeah, there was another one that was MT squared. The MT squared you shouldn't take too seriously. The MT squared don't, saying that it's quadratic in M is true for the MC and M up, but for M top it's not so, clear that it's actually, it's not really true that it goes like M top squared. So I was, the actual formula is in the book, but it's what has to happen in that graph. So your intuition, I think, is not wrong. It's so there was this graph, and so here we had the, you know, top charm and up, and here we had W. And so the thing is that the statement is that if the masses of these this loop, whatever the loop is some function of, once you pull out MW for dimensional grounds, what's left is a function of M squared of these quarks divided by MW squared. And so if all these masses were small, then it would be true what I said. What I told you literally was true if the masses were small compared to MW. So then this is, you know, would have been F naught plus M squared over MW squared, and so on. And then you're just really doing a Taylor expansion, and you're keeping the first term, and it's just growing because it's growing because you're looking at it for small values, and it had to go up or down. It was going up, but if you really were to take the limit where the quark mass is bigger than the W mass, then it has to be true that on the dimensional grounds, you know, if this whole amplitude goes like, you know, there was a 1 over MW squared that came out of the whole thing. So if on dimensional grounds, if the biggest mass in the problem is the top quark, then it'll be 1 over M top squared that comes out. So as the top quark gets infinitely large, the whole thing starts to fall like it's supposed to fall. And it's just that, and the explicit function is in, you can, if you actually look at the function that's in the book, you can kind of watch what happens when that, because I give both the limit, large and small mass limits, and you can see that it does go down. It goes down like 1 over M squared log M or something like that, so it does what you're supposed to do. It's just that M but in real life, the estimate you get by, so you might ask, I was comparing, you know, lambda to the 10th M top squared to lambda squared M charm squared or something when in deciding which one was most important for chaos. And the reason that's not such a bad answer is that you know, this function, it's linear in the M squared until these are the same size, and then it starts to fall. And M top and MW are, you know, they're within a factor of 3 of each other, so that the estimate you get by just using the mass squared is basically, you know, right. So it's to the level of the accuracy of the whole thing, because there's factors involved in the strong matrix elements, which are also factors of 2 or things like that. So I'm not misleading you too much with that, but it's true that for the top quark, you shouldn't take seriously that it's just, the argument I gave you for it doesn't really work for the top quark. And then you need the more accurate formulas that are in the book. Any other questions? So the story so far was, the thing about this room is that there's no place to leave the book. So the story so far is that, you know, for the KK bar system, the fact that the weak interactions exist implies that they oscillate. That's to say that the propagation eigenstates are not K and K bar, they're what I call K plus and K minus. Don't confuse this with a charge, you know, there's a charge K on too. So more traditionally you'd call this K short and K long. And the reason that they're called k-short and k-long has to do with CP. So let me talk about CP endurance. So in a world where CP is conserved, so if CP were a symmetry, it's not a symmetry, but it's a much better approximation to a symmetry than C is or P is. And so it's the evidence that it's not a symmetry comes from the system, and so it's worth knowing what would you have expected if CP were a symmetry, so then you'll know if you don't see that, CP wasn't a symmetry. So if CP were a symmetry, then you could always choose to label your states by, you could make your states, you know, CP on K up to some phase is going to be K bar. And so, and I'm not going to follow the phase. But given that that's true, you can always, and given that that CP commutes with the Hamiltonian, I'm always free to diagonalize my Hamiltonian and simultaneously diagonalize CP if I like. So if CP is a symmetry, and I can choose, I'm guaranteed that the propagation eigenstates will, if they're degenerate, I can always choose to diagonalize CP. If they're not degenerate, I'm guaranteed that they will be CP eigenstates because CP commutes to the Hamiltonian. So energy eigenstates to be CP eigenstates. So let's call those K plus and K minus. So let's say CP K plus or minus is plus or minus. K plus or minus. Let me call the corresponding states phi plus or minus. So rather, let me just phrase this in terms of the fields I was originally using, because I want to make a point. So phi plus or minus would correspond to, you know, phi plus phi bar, if CP takes them into one another, as I assume they did. And so that would be phi plus and phi minus. The way I wrote it was phi minus phi bar. Now, if in the kaon system CP were a symmetry, then what would happen, that has big implications into how long these things live. And the fact that these things are called short and long is related to that statement. So how do these things decay? So the claim I'm going to make is that the CP positive state for kaons is much shorter lived. And the CP equals minus state. Why is that? It's a combination, it's really an accident. So how do these things decay? Well, they typically, you know, so if you think of the, what we're looking at is a system involving a down quark and a strange quark, let's say. And the strange quark is decaying to an up quark plus things. And one thing it could decay to was an up quark and a lepton and an antineutrino. But it could also decay to an up quark and a pair of quarks. So it could decay to an up quark. We wanted to have negative charge, so it would have to be an anti-up quark and a down quark. And if this happens, this corresponds to the case like K naught. So something within a strange is an anti-K. So it would be going to an up and a down bar and lepton, so that would have to be a pi plus. It's got to be positive charge to balance the lepton charge. But this would correspond to, the k would be to, say, a pion and another pion. So it would be something like pi plus pi naught, or sorry, pi plus pi minus, or pi naught, pi naught. And if you look at the which of these wins? This one wins for one of the kaon states, for the short-lived kaon state. almost all the time it goes to 2 pi ions. And so, and there's a good reason for that. So this is a comparatively common decay. So for it turns out that for the long-lived kaons, this happens about half the time, and the other half of the time it goes to 3 pi ions. And for the short-lived kaons, it goes to this one basically all the time. And so the what I want to ask is, what decides whether it goes to 2 pi ions or 3 pi ions? And the answer is CP. If CP was conserved, so if CP is conserved, then the CP of the final 2 pi ion state has to be equal to the CP of the initial one. For the CP of 2 pi ions, each of these things is odd under CP because they're parity odd and their charge conjugation even. So we're going to get a minus squared, one for each pi ion. But if they're, but CP is also interchanging the two, right? Because parity takes position to minus position. And so if these things, if I think of these things as being in a relative angular momentum eigenstate, then if I take position to minus position, then you know that all the odd spherical harmonics are odd under that, and all the even ones are even. So I would have gotten a minus to the L if these things were in angular momentum L. But if these things are coming from kaon decays, kaons have no spin. So there's no angular momentum to start off with. Pions have no spin. So the only angular momentum in the final state is L. And so L has to be 0 if pi pi came from K decay. So that says that a 2 pi ion state coming from the decay of a kaon has to have CP even. So in K to pi pi, the CP of the pi pi is even, always. And that says that if we have states now which are even or odd under K, under CP, one of them cannot decay. The even one has to be the one that decays to 2 pi ions. And if you see decay to 3 pi ions, that has to be the odd one. I said that wrong. If you see decay to 2 pi ions, that had to be the even one. The odd one, it would depend on the relative angular momentum of these pi ions. So only CP even K0 combination can decay into 2 pi's. Why do you care? You care because there's an accident that the mass of a kaon is basically 480 MeV, and the mass of a pion is basically 140, I guess. So twice the mass of a pion is, you know, 280. And 3 times the mass of a pion is 420. 4 times the mass of a pion is too much. And the main point is that there's more phase space for this decay. You know, you've got something like 200 MeV of energy to release, and there is this decay where there's only about 60 MeV of energy. So if all the matrix elements are roughly the same, remember the total rate is always the matrix element squared integrated over the volume of phase space. And so if everything else is equal, the more volume of phase space you have, the bigger the rate is. So what you're expecting is that this process, which involves the release of more energy, should be fast, all other things being equal. And this should be slower. So because of this accident of the masses, this not being so different from that, it means that the CP even combination of its kaons can decay into the combination which has a faster rate, whereas the CP odd combination, this can also decay into 3 pi ions, but that's something which is going to be more rare given that this is faster. The CP odd combination is forbidden from taking this faster rate, so it's going to have a slower lifetime, or a slower decay rate. And so So the K short is the one that decays faster, and it's so it's the thing that would be a CP even in a world where CP is conserved. And the K long would be the one that's CP odd in the CP conserving world. And it's, you know, experimentally it's true that the rate for the short decay is something like 580 times the rate for the long decay. So there's a factor of about 5 to 600 in the difference of the lifetimes here, largely attributable to the phase space. So that's why they're called long and short. The fact that they're called long, this is actually true experimentally, is reflects the fact that CP, although it's not an exact symmetry, it's close to being a good symmetry. And so this is almost true. It's not exactly true in real life. And the reason you know it's not exactly true is that every once in a while, one of these guys decays into a CP odd combination. I said that wrong. Every once in a while, they take the wrong, they decay the wrong way. So so every so often, K short can go to pi pi pi, and K long can go to pi pi. And that's the one that's the smoking gun, that there's a problem. And so how often, the branching ratio for K long to go to two pions is, let me quote it here. So this is the charge pions is two times 10 to the minus 3. And the neutral pions, pi naught, it's 9 times 10 to the minus 4. So one in 1,000 decays, it goes the wrong way. And that was the way that CP violation was discovered. So this implies CP is not conserved. So one question we can have is, do we have an understanding in the standard model? We don't expect CP to be conserved in the standard model because there's a phase in the KM matrix. But do we have some sort of sense as to why it's almost conserved so well here? And the answer is yes, that it, we do. And so what the issue here is, there's several issues actually, but one issue is so the question is why in the standard model should the CP violating amplitude 10 to the minus 3 of the already small amplitude just for the k's to mix. It's actually the rate is 10 to the minus 3 of that. But that's gonna, they're gonna interfere with each other. And so it's 6 to 1, half dozen the other. So what would you need to break CP? So just to break CP requires a phase. And in the Wolfenstein parametrization of the KM matrix that we've been using, so W, IJ, we had 1, 1, 1. This is up, term top, down, strange bottom, lambda, lambda, lambda squared, lambda cubed. And the phases are all here, and these off-diagonal things. And so you had to get involved the third generation somehow to get a phase. So what we're asking, you know, the dominant part of the KK-bar mixing of, say, delta M for the kaons That was all coming from that. That was coming from this box graph. And the important contribution in that case turned out to be the charm quarks. And there's no phases there. In this way of thinking about things, you know, that's charm. If we're only talking about up-down charm and strange quarks, there would be no CP violation at all. In the standard model with two generations, there are no phases. So what we're asking here, if we're comparing the size of the CP violating contribution to the size of the CP preserving contribution, we're asking in this system, what's the relative size of this compared to that? Where you've got a third generation in here, say. Because here you do have a, here you have a phase on the, so in the TS vertex, we've got a phase. Sorry, on the TD vertex, we've got a phase. So we've got phases that can appear. We have a D, S, S, D. There's phases that can appear here and here. Or sorry, here. Here and here. But we did that exercise already, right? We had, this was lambda to the 10th. I forgot what it was now. But rather than working out again, let me just remind you what it was. Yeah, so the relative size is, it was lambda to the 8th. We had lambda to the 10th. This was lambda squared m charm squared. And this was lambda to the 10th m top squared, more or less. So the relative size of this to this, so CP breaking over CP preserving, in order of magnitude is going to be something like lambda to the 8th times m top squared over m charm squared. That's 0.2 to the 8th times, you know, 170 over 1 squared. And that's something like 0.01. So, you know, again, factors of 10. The factor of 10 in the previous thing I used last time, I said that 0.2 squared was 0.1. With the rules I'm using, 0.04 was really 0.01. That was, I would have been within a factor of 10 if I'd done that. So within the same kind of factor of 10, you can see why, in the standard model, qualitatively, the CP violating contribution to kaon mixing should be small. But you also see why, if we had done the same argument for B instead of S, the argument changes. Because in that case, for B physics, the argument I gave you was that in that the factors of lambda, so the punishment for mixing in the mixing matrix between this and this was essentially the same. And the relative size of the top graph to the charm graph was just controlled by the mass. So whereas in the kaon system, you're expecting CP violation to be small, if this is the source of it, in the B physics system, you're not expecting it to be small. So you're expecting to see CP violation basically in your face when you look at the B physics. And that's more or less what happens. There's a separate issue which I'm not going to go into, but which is in the book, and that's to do with, there's, you know, if you do see, there's a distinction of two, you know, if somebody shows you CP violation in a decay, so given CP violation is seen, is it due to KK bar mixing, or due to direct CP violation? The issue here is, you know, if supposing you see a decay from K long to 2 pi, there's two ways in which you could imagine that happening. You could say, well, Well, what that means, the fact that you see that means that the matrix element from pi pi for the weak interactions for k long, that's not zero, because you're seeing that decay. It would have been forbidden by CP conservation, but it's not zero, so CP can't be a symmetry. But there's two ways in which this could happen. What could happen is that, you know, k long is one combination. It's C1 times k. If I write this thing in terms of the CP eigenstates, why didn't I do that? So here's an aside. If CP is broken, then the mass eigenstates psi plus and minus that I talked about are not the same as phi plus and minus, which I defined to be the CP eigenstates. So I've erased it already, but I wrote down today, this afternoon, these guys in terms of the original phi and phi bar, and they were just linear combinations, phi plus phi bar over root 2. And this was the thing I got by diagonalizing the mass terms. If CP had been a good symmetry, they would have been the same thing, but they're not. And so it's useful to think of writing these mass eigenstates in terms of this basis rather than the phi and phi bar basis, because this is almost a good basis, but not quite. So in a CP validating world, we can write them, and that defines a parameter which people quote all the time. So it's useful to write this as that's phi plus minus I epsilon. I'm going to call it epsilon hat. Phi minus divided by the normalization. And then psi minus, is phi minus plus I epsilon hat. And the fact that CP violation is seen at the order at the level of 10 to minus 3, you can take to mean that epsilon hat is something like 10 to minus 3 in size. So there's a very small admixture of the wrong CP eigenstate in the mass eigenstates. Now the question that this is asking is that all that's going on? So there's two ways in which you can imagine this matrix element to be non-zero. One would be that this is actually this is the delta S equals plus or minus 1 part of the Hamiltonian, which is describing a decay, because that's got strangeness 1 or minus 1, and this has got no strangeness. Whereas this is coming about from the delta S equals 2 part of the Hamiltonian, because that's the thing that converts a kaon to an anti-kaon, so it has changed strangeness by 2 units. And the question here is the CP violation tied to this selection rule, or is it tied to this selection rule, or is it in both places? If it was all here, that would mean that even though this particular interaction is CP preserving, that means that the only thing that can have a non-zero matrix element is K plus here. There is an overlap between K long and K plus here, which is epsilon. And so the prediction, if all the CP violation is there, would be that the CP violation is being controlled by this parameter epsilon, which tells you how much the wrong CP eigenstate mixes into the KK bar system. So we could have that L weak delta S equals plus or minus 1 CP conserving. But then the pi pi L weak delta S equals plus or minus 1 K long is proportional to epsilon hat pi pi L weak K plus. That's allowed to be non-zero by CP conservation, and so the CP violation is all in that case in the overlap between that and that. That's one thing that could happen. It could also be true that the matrix element pi pi L weak delta S equals plus or minus 1, K minus is not 0. So regardless of, you don't need to have an overlap with K plus here. It could be that this breaks CP. In which case, that's a completely different source of, you wouldn't need to have the K long have any overlap at all with K plus to get a non-zero answer, because the K minus part of K long would already be giving you something non-zero. And so, given only one measurement of CP violation, you can't distinguish them, but there's actually three or four ways to measure CP violation in the K-ON system. So CP violation is seen, you can look for K long goes to pi plus pi minus, that's one observable. You can look for K long goes to pi naught, that's another observable. You can look for the difference between let me get this right. It's basically compare the rate for decaying into leptons. So what we'll look for here is we'll look for the rate for this to happen divided by the rate for this to happen. And we'll look for the rate for this to happen divided by the rate for the other kaon to do this, which we know it does all the time. Those two things are called eta pi plus, pi minus, and this is called eta naught naught. It's a dimensionless ratio. And the other thing we can look for is the rate for k long goes to pi plus lepton minus nu minus the rate for k long goes to pi minus lepton plus nu divided by the sum. That's something which is also sensitive to CP violation, because you're taking the same state here and you're just asking for it to go into the CP opposite final state. So here are three observables. So the relative size of direct CP violation versus mixing, you can find by comparing what you see in all three of those things. Because if all you had was mixing, you have only one parameter to describe everything. These three observables. And the bottom line is that they're both there. But this happens, the rate for this is about 1,000 times smaller than the rate for the CP violation in the mixing. One of the things that we're going to get to later on is that almost everything you do to modify the Higgs sector gives you CP violation in your face. So constraints on CP violation are really useful, because CP violation doesn't like to happen in the standard model. It's, to get it, you have to change flavor through several generations, because you have to involve all three generations, and you're punished in the standard model every time you change flavor. So the fact that CP violation, so epsilon, which is basically epsilon prime, epsilon hat over there, is of the order of 10 to the minus 3, measures CP violation in KK bar mixing. That's what we've already seen. But what's called epsilon prime over epsilon, which is also 10 to the minus 3, measures the relative size of direct versus KK bar CP violation. So the statement is, observationally, you see CP violation, it's small, and the direct CP violation is even smaller. That's the bottom line. Any questions about that? So you say, you're just on the edges of your seat because you want to see the B physics, because B physics has got CP violation in your face. What about B physics? So what we're expecting is CP violation not small. T quark, you're sensitive to the top quark because of the box graph, sensitive to T quark. And that's essentially what you see. It's trickier to see it, though, because you know what did you actually measure in the kaon system? What you measured was some process where you produced some kaons. You saw the you produced a k-naught and a k-naught bar together. You saw the k-naught decay. And then some later time, you saw the k-naught bar decay. And you distinguished them because they decayed into opposite side leptons, let's say. And you measured the time in between the two because the thing actually went in the lab some distance. And so you could measure the distance between where they decayed. That's trickier to do for the B physics because for Bs, B mesons, so again you have a B and a B naught B bar, and you've got a D type and you've got an S type. And they decay with a lifetime, which is something like 10 to the minus 12 seconds. So that's actually, so for comparison, a muon was 10 to the minus 6 seconds. The W boson, the generic things in the standard model decay with 10 to the minus 23 seconds. So this is very long-lived compared to the typical things that you see in the standard model. But if you're going at the speed of light, you know, c times tau, 10 to the minus 10 to the 8 meters, you know, 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second in this in 10 to the minus 12 seconds, you're going something like 10 to the minus 4 meters, right? So you're going, you know, fractions of a millimeter. This is kind of a ballpark number, but if you could measure, and you can measure, because this is an interestingly, this is an observably large number, even though it's not easy to see. In detectors, what they actually do is you have typically particles colliding, and there's an interaction, and if you produce things like W's and Z's, they decay right away before they even move, and you just see a whole bunch of stuff radiating out from the same point. But something like a B meson, if it's produced, it'll actually move for about a millimeter, or maybe less than that, maybe in 10 microns or something like that, and then it'll decay. And so you'll see things, you'll see tracks that if you reconstruct them, they go back to a point which is not the same point where all the other things went out. So if you have a production process where you get a B meson together with something else, the something else all leaves from here, but the B meson decays all come from here. And so that motivated them to look in these, to design into the middle of the detector a tracker which could actually measure accurately the positions of these decays with a resolution of, you know, of microns to millimeters. So you can actually see these things decay, but it's not easy. And so the whole process of watching how things vary as a function of time and these oscillations won't be so easy either because they're not going very far. So what? And it's also true that you don't get so many of these things. You produce B mesons, but they're not produced so often that you get a lot of them. And to do the measurements, you need something, the rule of thumb is you need ballpark of 100 million Bs to measure with some significance things like CP violation in the B system. Just even if it's not suppressed, what do you need to actually measure it? So you need lots of Bs. So what they do when they're looking for Bs is they run at actually not at very high energies, they run at reasonably low energies. There's a... to produce lots of Bs. So first statement is you need, you know, 10 to the 8 or more B-B bar pairs to measure, you know, CP violation or anything else you want to do accurately. So how do you get that many? What you do is to get this many, you take E plus E minus collisions, but you run it with a center mass energy. Tuned to what's called the epsilon. How do you do an epsilon? I'm losing epsilon. Epsilon. That's what this is. This is an epsilon. Forest state. So this is what this is. This is one of those BB bar bound states. And this 4s is telling you, you know, these heavy quarks, they bind together in a hydrogen-like way because the Bohr radius for these quarks, because the mass of the B quark is much bigger than the QCD scale, the Bohr radius is basically 1 over alpha strong times the mass. That's much smaller than lambda QCD, the confinement scale. So these things, to good approximation, are just seeing a Coulomb-like force because they're so close together that they never probe the long-distance, strongly coupled parts of QCD. So these are like hydrogen or like positronium levels or systems. They're labeled spectroscopically like you do the hydrogen atom, SPD. S means it's an angular momentum zero thing. And this is just one particular one of them. And they decay, you know, they have a spectroscopy, they decay into one another. But this is one that has a nice property that because it's relatively long-lived, when you collide, E plus E minus goes to epsilon 4s, goes to something else, you're going to get a nice resonance because just like you got a resonance when we went through a Z boson. So the cross-section will have a nice property like that as a function of energy. And the other thing that's nice about this is that, you know, why don't you choose the epsilon 1s or 2s or 3s? This one is high enough energy that it's just a little bit heavier than 2B mesons. So the mass of the 4s is just a little bit bigger than twice the mass of a B meson, these mesons. So once you produce these things, they can decay into a B-B bar pair, and the B-B bar pair are almost at rest because there's almost no energy left over once you produce their mass. So you can get B and so it's great. You've got a way of sitting on a resonance. You take advantage of the fact you get lots of events because you're going to sit right at the resonance, and you produce exactly what you want to see, and they're not moving very fast. So you can watch them do what they're going to do. And so you don't get to quite do something so simple as watching, you know, the B decays here and the B bar decays here. What happens instead is that you, because this thing, the process for this collision takes place, you know, it's basically a B, B bar, annihilates into a photon, which produces, sorry, E plus E minus. Actually, I did it right the first time. I go this way, right? E minus E plus. It's basically at these low, these are, the energies involved here are very low compared to the W mass. And these things are bound at few GeVs, because that's the mass of these guys is few GeVs. It's mostly photon exchange that's responsible. And so what happens is that the B-B bar pair gets produced in a correlated state. It's like an EPR state, Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen state. So since the photon, so the production method gives the BB bar in an initial state, which is basically, so there's 1 over root 2. You know, so you've got a B with momentum K, a B bar with momentum minus K, plus or minus. It's odd, I think. So it's, I think it's minus. Minus, yeah. So you're producing, you don't have a B and a B bar the way you normally think of particles being produced. You have actually an EPR correlation between the flavor of the meson and the momentum of the meson. And this particular combination has the angular momentum and parity properties of the initial photon that had to go, if you're producing something from a photon channel, this thing has to have the same properties as a photon does, basically, and that's why it has a, it comes to you in a particular combination like this. So it's a little bit trickier to, you don't know when you see a bee decay, was it this bee or was it this bee? So you don't know which direction it was going. And so the issue of how you pick out the time difference between the decay of the bee and the decay of the bee bar gets complicated by the fact that your initial state is correlated like that. And in particular, if you integrate over, I'm about to lie to you, I think. Yeah. Yeah, no, I wasn't going to lie to you at all. That's all right. So let me give you the expression first. So the observable you'd like to look at is you'd like to, you produce this state, you watch the bee, so the bee can decay the same way. You know, this is a bee was a bee, let's take a bee bar. It's a bee, say, D bar. And the bee is going to decay into, it could decay into charm or up. There's more channels because it's a heavier quark. So let's say it decays into charm and lepton, let's say. So again, we went from a minus one-third to a plus two-thirds, so we have to have a negatively charged electron. Whereas the B would have decayed to, the same argument would have been to, so this would be a meson with a C and a D is a, called a D meson. So this is a, this would be the decay B goes to D plus L minus nu. Where the D plus is a charm and a down quark, anti-quark. And this would correspondingly go to a D minus L plus nu. So what you could do is you could look for one decay like this and one decay like this. Or if you're looking for CP violation, you could look for one decay like this and then you could ask for if it oscillates over to the B, you could ask for it to decay the wrong way. So if you're producing a, you've got to, always got a B, B bar, if you ask for, say, two like sign leptons to come out, that would be the sign that the, one of these guys decayed the wrong way. That's one thing you could do. Another thing you could do is you could look for the B to decay into a CP eigenstate. So another thing people look for is they look for B goes to something like a, there's a charm bar bound state called the J psi. Because two people discovered it and couldn't agree on what to call it. So you can look for this goes to J psi I'm drawing a blank. What's the So if you look for a decay into two mesons like this, these have the property that they are basically close to being CP eigenstates, because remember the K short was almost a CP eigenstate, and this thing is a bound state of two heavy quarks, and so it's labeled by the quantum numbers of heavy quark states, and so it has also the specific CP charges. What you can do is you can look for, if you're looking for CP violation, you can look for B to decay, and you can compare that to, it can decay directly or it can oscillate to a B bar, and that can decay to the same thing. And normally that would be forbidden by CP violation because this thing is a CP eigenstate and these things are the CP transformations of each other. But these amplitudes can interfere with each other in the case where CP is broken, and so it allows you a particularly clean handle on how big the CP violation is in this particular rate. And this is taking me off track of this. The bottom line of both these things is that you'd like to be able to see the time difference between when the first B decays to when the second B decays, because you're looking for an oscillation signal where you see something vary as a function of time, and that time is the time between this decay and that decay. And the problem is always that you've produced the thing in a correlated state, and they don't go very far. And they're almost at rest, so they really don't go very far. So when they build these machines, what they do, so in order to measure the t dependence, or what's the same thing as how far they go of the oscillations, what they do is instead of having these two, so somewhere I've drawn it, the electron-positron collision, instead of having them have exactly the same energy, what they do is they have an asymmetric beam where these ones have a little bit more energy than these ones do. So the center of mass is actually moving in the lab frame. And because of that, this whole BB bar system is actually moving in the lab frame, and then you can actually watch it decay, and then you can, if you've given it some velocity in your detector, which you can actually resolve. It makes it travel far enough that you can resolve how far it's gone. So you build what's called an asymmetric collider. I don't know how much detail I want to do. There's one last thought I want to give you here, and that's the unitarity triangle. Let's do that. Any questions about this so far? It's just going to, I want to, if you hear any news about there being new physics in CP or any of the meson mixing, you're going to hear it in the context of the unitarity triangle. So let me give you that. So the thrust of the logic of testing the standard model in these things is that in the standard model, all flavor physics and CP violation comes from the KM matrix, you know, VIJ. And so, and what's constraining the GYM mechanism and what's making the KK bar mixing small and all those things is the statement that what's special about V is that V is unitary. So that says that the, you know, if you write V out, VU, DVUS, VB. I want to write two rows. In particular, I want to write two columns. Now, V being unitary is a statement that each of these rows and each of these columns, the elements sum, the squares of the elements, the absolute squares of the elements square to one, sum to one. And all the rows are orthogonal to each other, and all the columns, all the rows are orthogonal to each other, all the columns are orthogonal to each other. And so in particular, for B physics, I want to focus on those two columns. For B sub D physics, if I'm looking at mesons which involve D quarks and B quarks, those are the interesting ones. And so this implies the statement that VUD star VUB plus VU CD star VCB plus VTD star VTV is equal to 0, right? That's a special case of the statement that says unitary. And this is normally called the unitary triangle because it's a statement that, you know, there's essentially three complex numbers here, and they're adding to 0. So if you wrote that in the complex plane, you know, you've got three complex numbers which have this property, where each of these, you know, say this would be VUD, star VUB, VCD star VCB. Now, the point of the measurements that you make at the, in for B mesons and for other things is that you've got many, many things that, you know, a triangle, if you give me two sides and an angle, I know everything, right? So the idea is that there's many ways to measure the length of these things because the absolute values of these things, you know, the length of this vector would be the absolute value of these matrix elements. And you can measure that in decay processes, say, or you can measure that in a variety of things that are only looking at rates. The angles you can get at, but those tend to require CP violating observables to see. So I want to do an example to show you how you get a hold of those angles. And then the idea is that by measuring the sides in many ways and the angles in many ways, you ask, are you getting something which is consistent with the triangle? Because the standard model predicts that they have to all be satisfying all the geometrical relationships that are associated with a triangle. And there's more than one observable, more than three observables that you're using to fix the triangle. So let me make that argument. But I want to first label the angles of this triangle in a particular way. So the angle between the T's and the U's, that's this one, is normally called alpha. The one between the T's and the C's is normally called beta, and this is normally called gamma. And in the Wolfenstein way of writing this matrix where these are all real, you can see that in that case, it's only TD and UB that are complex. So that's complex and that's complex. So if I wrote it in the conventional way that I've been writing things before, this would actually point along the real axis. So I think I've actually written this backwards. But in the complex plane, the triangle would be something like this. It'd be more like that. So this would be V CD star VCB. This would be V, I want that to be beta, so that would be TD star VTB, and this would be V UD star VUB. That would be beta. C and U is gamma and alpha, if I've done that right. So that's the plan. So when you look at this, what you're looking at here is this is the complex plane. The triangle you're talking about would have one origin is down. The origin here is here, where these lines intersect is here, and where all these arcs are intersecting is here. And what those different curves are describing are measurements of the lengths. So these arcs tend to be measurements of these lengths. And there's some error, and any measurement will allow some sort of a stripe in this plane. And the idea is that if all these things are being described by this triangle, you'll find that the consistent place for all these measurements will be, they'll all point to a common overlap, which will correspond to where this corner of the triangle is. And so you're looking for observables that can measure these angles, that can measure these sides, and this is a summary of the experiments as they stood a couple years ago. And the fact that they overlap is the sign that the standard model is working really well. But let me give you the argument that would give you the measurement of beta, say. All right. So from the picture here, you can see that the angle that we're talking about here is just, given that that was real, this is essentially the argument of the, if I think of this being an absolute value in a phase, we're talking about the phase of these things, right? So the so I want to write that alpha is the argument of VTD VTB star. So it's VU. Here I've got the complex conjugates reversed. Beta is the argument of, it's again, it's going to be TD and CD. So CD, CD star. And so on. So now what we're going to look for is, we're going to look for this, we'll look for BB bar goes to, so one of these guys will go to a lepton, so a meson. So let's say it's D or D star or something times a lepton times a neutrino. And this other guy, what we'll do is we'll ask for it to go to a psi k short, I guess. So the observable we'll look for is the rate for the decay into a positive lepton, something else, and a neutrino at time t1, followed by decay psi k short at t2. And we'll subtract that from the rate the other way around with a negatively charged electron, x nu at t1, and psi k short at t2. That's our observable, let's call that D. Actually, to tell you this, I'm gonna have to tell you something I skipped. Shit. Well, I'll just quote it for you. I mean, what's happening here is basically the, you know, I gave you the probability for a B to go to B bar after some time T. I gave you that for in general. If you specialize it to the case for B mesons, you know, the difference between the two decay rates is much less than the decay rate itself, unlike for kaons. And it's going to be comparable to the difference in the masses. No, that's not so important. So I'm just going to call gamma. I'm not going to tell you which gamma it is because they're the same. So if I specialize the formulas you had before to this case, then you've got, it boils down to this. And the probability for the B to go to a, this was a survival one, sorry, B to go to B bar is, Q over P squared times the same thing. And Q over P in this system is close to being a phase. As you can kind of see from the, well, let me not go into that. It's, you can see that if you look in the book. So the main idea is that, so what's happening here, right? You've got the, this is just telling you, if you see this, then you've seen a B or a B bar decay. And so now you're asking for the other one to decay to this. And there's two amplitudes that you want to interfere. One of them is the direct decay. So if this was a, what did we decide, the B, the B bar goes to the L minus. So this is, so if you see this first, that means that you had a B, B zero decay, followed by a B bar, which had to go to psi k short. If you see this, you had a, this shows that you initially had a B bar decaying, And so then you had a B0 that was produced with it, which went to psi k short. And so you're interested in the rate for B0 bar going to psi k short, and you're comparing that to the rate for B going to psi k short. And these are CP eigenstates, and so that means that you're directly looking at something which is two different, CP violating observable, because if CP were conserved, these rates would have to be the same. So the important thing I want to get you to is I want to get you to the phase of this thing. Basically, I want to get you to an estimate to how big this is. And I want to use as much as possible what I did for kaon physics. And I'm not going to make it. Thing you're going to have to be convinced of, which I'm not going to be able to do an honest job of, is why the CP violating phase here is coming from the KM angles and nothing else. I'm going to bail out at this point, I think. Partly because I got a sense you don't really care so much. Who wants to see this argument in detail? If you really want to see the argument in detail, I'll prepare it for next time. So what's the argument I'm asking about? What's the point of the exercise? This measurement. So let me show you the line we're going to get to, and then you can see why you care. So the claim is, and this is the thing I'm not doing justice to, is that this observable here, D, is it has to be phrased in terms of, we're interested in the amplitude psi k short, the weak interactions, and B, let's say that that's E, that's some amplitude with a phase. And let's say this is a CP violating phase. There's also some matrix element for the B bar. And so it's going to be the same amplitude, E to the minus IXC. So this C is the thing that expresses CP violation in this matrix element. We don't know what the matrix element is. So in terms of those parameters, this thing that this observable I wrote down is given by basically, it's twice k squared e to the minus gamma t1 plus t2 times sine 2 beta times sine of delta m T1 minus T2. So what's happening here is you're asking for the process where you're asking for this process, basically, right? The reason you're seeing the sign of the mass difference and this is that you're seeing the oscillation. That the one way in which this could happen is that you just have the direct decay. The other way it could happen is that you have the B bar oscillates to a B and then decays. So if I imagine that I have the B bar decay, the B decays first, the B bar could go right to psi k short, or the B bar could go to a B, which it could then go to psi k short. So the total amplitude for this thing is going to be, this process is given by that, A e to the minus I xc, but it's interfering with the process here, which is going to be the mixing amplitude, which is these p's and q's, which is basically coming down to this. So it's mixing amplitude times the process for b to go to psi k curve, which is this one. And I'm trying to square that, is essentially what I'm doing. And so if you use the amplitudes that give you this, and you use it, the mixing is coming from these parameters q over p, and you use it for b quarks, q and p are basically the matrices c, the Lagrangian we had was c phi squared, and or b phi squared and c phi bar squared. These things are coming from the box diagram with the top quark in between being the dominant thing, because when you've got b quarks on the outside legs, the top quark wins. Then the CP violating phase here is coming from these km angles, because you really do have a phase when you have the td vertex. You know, this thing has phases in it. The ub and the td vertex has phases in it. The CP violating phase here, c, is coming from these km angles here. And that's why when you do the mixing, so the logic is the mixing is q over p. Q over p is really some linear combination of b and c. B and C are coming from this graph, and so the CP violating part of it is all in here, and it's coming from the the mixing is coming from here, and the CP violating part of it that I'm writing here is coming from the phases of the KM angles. And so if you trace in this interference, so if I take the difference here, you pick out the CP violating part, and so you see something which vanishes if there's no CP violation. It cares about this phase, and the phase appears as sine 2 beta here, because sine 2 beta is exactly the phase of these km angles, and these are the km angles that would be appearing in this mixing. And so the thing that I'm not doing properly is dotting all the i's and showing you why it's exactly this combination of km angles which is appearing here, as opposed to the other ones. But the bottom line is that this is an example of, so you measure this process, you can see, measure these times, you can pick out the coefficients here, and so that allows you to give gives you a handle on what this angle is, and so you've measured one of the angles of the triangle, which you can compare to other measurements of the lengths and the other angles, which you can get from other processes involving different kinds of decays. To measure this angle, instead of following things that involving I'm beating myself to death here. You know, you get these different angles from looking at different observables. So are you convinced? Or do you want to see it in more detail? The reason I want to punt this is that I need to get back. We need to take the van at 5 exactly today. Because there's a meeting we have to get back to from Master. So I just need a last statement from you guys for next class, whether or not you want to see this done honestly, or if you're really engaged that much. Next step would be, if you don't really care so much about the details here, the next step, you know, the main message that you should take home from this is that there's an enormously redundant test of the standard model going on here, and that you, this is what, that's what you want to watch, is the failure of this picture. This picture has not failed, this triangle. And should there be a failure, that's saying that this is not the source of CP violation. That means the standard model is wrong. But if you want, I can fill in the details here. But if not, the next topic that would be neutrinos oscillation. That was in our list of things. That was the. So I see. I know what you vote for. It's not really. You'll get neutrino oscillations no matter what. It's just a question whether or not you want to have 10 minutes of this finished off before on the next class. Why don't you email me so you can just. Email me if you want to see this. If I hear nothing, I'll go right to neutrino oscillations.